Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios here in Beijing. I'm your host, Kaiser Guo. Joining me today are Jeremiah Jenny, Dean of Chinese Studies at IES in Beijing, and the blogger behind Jottings from the Granite Studio. Great to have you back, Jeremiah.
Thank you, Kaiser.
And also David Moser, Academic Director of Chinese Studies at Beijing CET and an accomplished jazz pianist, a polymath. How are you, David?
Pretty good. If my voice seems inexplicably sexy today, it's because I'm recovering from a cold.
Yeah, well, it's definitely sexy. Over here with a chub.
I know you mean that.
I do. Seriously, so you guys have never met before?
That's right.
Now, that is very strange because you have sort of analogous positions at analogous programs, and it's just bizarre to me.
I'm glad
that I could have facilitated the meeting of you two.
Actually, we both play the piano, too.
Okay. Cynica is supposed to be a current affairs podcast, right? But I want to put a little bit of a twist on it today. All three of us have actually had some formal training in Chinese history, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm more of a
linguist. Right, you've had plenty of history as well. And Jeremiah Noh is still a graduate student in Chinese history. I'm a dropout myself from an East Asian studies program where I was doing modern Chinese intellectual history as a focus. I thought that today we would talk about the importance of history in understanding China today, not only the way that Westerners or other non-Chinese interpret history, but also the way that historical understanding shapes the way that Chinese see their present and their future, and the way that interpretations of history shape politics. So Chinese historians have been, very conscious of the uses of history as cautionary tale or moral object lesson or what have you. This goes back a long way, at least to the time of Sima Qian in the Han Dynasty. 11 centuries later, the Song Dynasty historian Sima Guang, he actually called his historical work, was it a comprehensive mirror for aid in government? Chinese have been very conscious of the role of history in politics, in policy, in all things. That still continues very much today. For Western historians of China, maybe they were influenced by spending too much of their subjects, but they have a habit of pulling out historical analogy whenever it suits them. There's a tendency to see everything as sort of old wine and new bottles. And let's start off with some basic framing questions here. Does history matter more in China?
Well, two very blank stares.
Right.
Well, first of all, you were talking about this little parlor game that historians play. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know the Chinese do it too, but from the Western standpoint, you're looking at a culture that is, one of the oldest cultures that developed relatively independently from the West.
Sure.
So that for Western eyes, we sometimes look at the Chinese history as being, cyclical or as having repeating sort of themes. Mark Twain said history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. Mm-hmm. So we're always finding these rhymes because we tend to see them
Ming
as a special
rhymes with Qing.
Right? So I think it's more tempting for Westerners to look beyond the subtlety and just see some big themes that keep coming up again and again. And there's also a lot of social science that sees this longstanding continuity in Chinese. Because they contrast it with the Greek tradition,
right,
and see these contrasts in Chinese culture that seem to be, eternal. So that's one thing I would maybe just point out.
I pick up on that too. I think one of the reasons why there's a temptation to do this by Western commentators is because in the West we have a bad habit of essentializing, or if you will, to use the word, orientalizing China. Mm-hmm. And this idea that China is somehow this timeless, or unchanging civilization dating back X thousands of years. I hate to put an actual number there because I get yelled at no matter what I do.
I thought it was five. Canonically, it's 5,000
They
years.
Say five. What are just you're doubting them?
Bulgaria just found an 8,000-year-old relic, so I'm predicting that by tomorrow it'll be 8,001 years of Chinese civilization, but we'll get back to that later. But I mean, the idea that Chinese civilization is timeless, it creates a really strong temptation for people to then look and say, okay, well, what's happening now must be very similar to something that happened before. And so, while there are certainly some parallels, and we'll talk about those today, relating everything back to Confucius, which has been a habit of Western writers since the 17th or 18th century, is something we really need to get away from, because China is and has always been a very dynamic place. One of the principal characteristics of Chinese history that I see is great change, not great stasis.
I think it's fair to say that it's certainly not just Chinese historians or I'm sorry, it's not just Western historians of China who do this.
Yeah.
It's Chinese observers themselves. I mean, they're very fond still of invoking history for, you know, contemporary political purposes. Before we get on into some more meaty substance, I wanted to set this up a little bit more. Do you think that China is, in some sense, more burdened with historical baggage than other comparably powerful nations? For example, the United States, which I think arguably is the least burdened by history. We carry around the least baggage, for better or for worse. I mean, we're capable of these amazing feats of self-reinvention and stuff like that. But at the same time, we often are criticized for lacking historical context when we approach other countries. Is China more sort of fixated with history in that way?
Well, I think, you know, one of the similarities actually between U.S. and China in terms of history is that both American historians of the United States and Chinese historians of China get kind of trapped in an exceptionalist cul-de-sac where they see their histories as being so unique on the world stage that it creates some very kind of interesting distortions for how history is both remembered and how it's deployed in the present day. For example, America was always proud it wasn't an imperialist country except for that small adventure in Cuba and the Philippines.
Oh, Philippines, yeah.
Right. And, you know, China, of course, is and Chinese politicians and their errand boys are very fond of saying things like, you know, well, China's never invaded another country. It's not an imperialist power. Though both overlook the fact that the United States and China and the Qing Empire had a fairly long and successful history of westward expansion and the incorporation of
indigenous people,
indigenous people into the central petropole.
Right.
So, but those things are kind of seen differently because those are different from what the European powers did.
Right.
And this kind of exceptionalism, I think, still kind of colors the way we Chinese historians look at history. And so whether or not China – I know what your question is and sort of do Chinese historians relate to history differently than American historians, and perhaps they do. But sometimes I'm more struck by the similarities.
Oh, no. I think that's a very, very fair point. And I can imagine that if we had a major Chinese politician here talk down the idea of Chinese exceptionalism, I can see, you know, the Sarah Palin analogs here also, you know, crawling out to condemn him for not buying into exceptionalism. In China, I'm tempted to use the word exemptionism more than exceptionalism. Exceptionalism, for me, connotes this sort of providential thing that we are, Americans were the chosen people, the idea of a manifest destiny, the city on the hill, all that stuff, right? There's sort of this godliness about it. That isn't usually invoked in China. What I feel is a more defensive sort of exemptionism. It's like China should be exempt from those things. It's exempt from, you know, the universality of, say, human rights, or it's exempt from because of its unique historical experience. Isn't that?
Yeah, maybe putting somewhat of a fine point on it. But I mean, one thing is for sure, both American and Chinese share this quality of feeling that they are exceptional. There's a feeling of exceptionalism. In the Chinese case, it may take a different form in the way you're saying. But there's still, one of the bonds that the Americans and Chinese feel is they both feel that they're exceptional, you know, nations or civilizations or whatever. And maybe that's, you know, the G2 has this logic to it. That's, well, of course we're the two, you know, the most important countries in the world. And so, but Chinese, part of its importance, its self importance, is its history. I mean, they see themselves, you know, if you throw out the old thing of they don't think of themselves as a
nation state,
but as a civilization state,
masquerading as a nation.
That's different than from the U.S. I mean, we don't really think of ourselves as a civilization. We think of ourselves as a nation. So, I mean, I think in that sense, the Chinese who see themselves as a civilization state do see their history differently than we do. We also, you know, live by, we put great emphasis on it, but not in the same way.
This has become a popular trope again recently. Martin Jakes, in When China Rules the World, talks about it. He talks about the sort of resurrection of the tribute system, that China's conception of itself at the center, you know, of civilization with concentric circles of increasing levels of barbarism. Do we need to really understand this Middle Kingdom idea in order to understand China's concept of its place in the world? Or isn't China behaving like another nation state for the most part? I mean, in accession to WTO.
I have always thought that – I mean, it'll be interesting to see what Jeremiah says. But I have always thought that during the 80s, the 90s, when China's market suddenly became again – this thing to be drooled over by Western capitalists and still is. I mean, who's that chick, Diane Furstenberg, is in Beijing saying, I want to sell a luxury item to every single Chinese, you know, they're still saying this, you know. I always thought that during that period that Deng Xiaoping's attitudes towards the market as a draw was very much a tribute sort of thing. You know, it was like, yeah, okay, we'll let you come in, but you have to kowtow in various abstract ways. And it wasn't that towards the emperor, it was towards this mystical thing called the market, which China had at 1.something billion people. And I always thought that there was something so similar to that, that the dynamic was able to be continued during the 80s and 90s and still today. Not because China is the center of the world and everyone else is barbarians, but because they have this, instead of the center of the virtue of the emperor, you know, they have this magnetic attraction of the market. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I've always thought that the tribute system in terms of its historical significance has been really overblown. I mean, this idea of all these countries having to come to the kowtow to the emperor in a symbolic obeisance and therefore were able to again, you know, trade their products was a little bit during the Ming and during the Qing. In fact, the Manchu emperors basically said, you know, this tribute thing's not really working out for us. They would still accept it, but in terms of, you know, overall trade.
Right, but I don't really
know. But what the point though is that what David said, I think, has been going on for a long time. It's not about being the center of a tribute system. It's about being the center of a global trading empire, a global trading network. And, you know, China has, you know, probably since the Han Dynasty, but certainly since the Tang Dynasty, attracted merchants and traders and people seeking economic advantage from coming here. Not necessarily under any kind of Middle Kingdom idea, but just because this is where all the goods were.
Yep.
And eventually, you know, where the market was.
Yeah, I really want to challenge the idea that's out there right now that there's something sort of in the deep psyche of the Chinese being that insists that we bring back this old tributary system. Martin Jakes, I think that's one of the several points in his books that I really take issue with.
I love John Fairbanks. John Fairbanks is a great historian.
He is.
But, you know, what Martin Jakes is talking about there is something that Fairbanks wrote about in the 1950s and that, you know, historians in the 60s, 70s, and 80s are pretty of – if not done away with, significantly complicated.
It's changed though now. I mean, they were writing at a time when, you know, China's rise was not inevitability. I mean, China is now, at least on a PPP scale, the second biggest economy in the world, and it's.
But just getting back on the side a little bit of Martin Jakes. I mean, against you two guys, a little bit. The style of it seemed to be more imperial and less commercial. At least during the earlier period. Okay. Now I think you're right. I mean, it's basically gone into a contractual, you know, completely give and take in the international norms. But I mean, at the time, it certainly seemed because the rules that the foreigners were playing by seemed opaque. They weren't based upon what seemed in Western merchants' minds being rational economic considerations. It was more like, and they're also quite frankly also being played for other reasons besides merely trade and economic ones. So I mean, I agree with what you're saying, but I think it's the style and the feel of it, especially to some Western companies, was very much on the lines of a sort of tribute system, you know, psychologically anyway.
We'll go back and talk about more of these parallels that people tend to bring up. But first, I want to bring one up that came up just a couple of days ago in Caixin, which, if you don't know, is the magazine run by Hu Shuli, who, if you don't know her, is the former editor of Caijing magazine. Jeremiah pointed out this piece. It was in the online edition, in English only, by the way, titled The Revolution of 1911. The author of it was a woman by the name of Zhou Nailin, Nailin Zhou Vist, the director of global business journalism at Tsinghua, and she apparently used to work for Reuters. Jeremiah, this was an interesting piece, particularly for its very deliberate use of history on the eve of the year where we're celebrating the centennial of the 1911 revolution. What struck you as remarkable about this?
Well, there are a couple of things. As you mentioned, next year is another anniversary year. We just escaped one in 2009. Mm-hmm. And next year we get not only the 100th anniversary of the Wuchang Uprising, the October 1911 revolution, that began the process by which the Qing were removed from power, but also it's the 90th anniversary of the founding of the Chinese Communist Party, which is going to be celebrated by yet another big blockbuster movie. This piece, really talking about the 1911 revolution, I think it argues several parallels that people have talked about, but I don't think I've ever seen it quite distilled in a piece for a Chinese magazine. And the argument is something like this. You know, at the end of the Qing dynasty, in that last decade, the Qing really face a real dilemma, how to cope with the great social changes, the great inequalities that were that society was facing, just a lot of the problems of corruption that were creeping into the system. And the things that they were doing, the kind of piecemeal approaches to reform that they were making, were not nearly enough. And this article, I think the rather implicit in some cases, actually explicit,
blunt
point of this article was that, you know, they were willing to make changes only insofar as it wasn't going to affect their hold on power. Mm-hmm. And that was the border. That was the boundary. It was the invisible fence which the poodle would not run across. And so with we take a look now, we see a lot of problems in Chinese society, different problems. It's the parallels, obviously, that aren't exact. But at the same time, this article is making the argument that the Communist Party today will fix any of these problems up to the point where the solutions could in some way create the conditions by which their grip on power would be weakened.
Just to clarify the metaphor that you just invoked, because we're talking about all about analogies and metaphors, the poodle is the poodle didn't cross the line.
I wanted a puppy for Christmas. What can I say?
I'm sorry. Well, maybe this year, man, if you were a good boy. David, did you read this piece too?
Yeah.
And what was your takeaway from this?
Well, I thought it was – one thing I was puzzled. This was in – this was, of course, in the English –
and only online as far as I know.
Only online. But it seemed rather gutsy in using terms like a princeling cabinet.
Oh, yeah. Princeling.
Yes. I mean this – I was just imagining this being translated into Chinese. I don't know if it would make it into the Chinese version.
No, I don't think it would. I mean princeling becomes taizidang.
Yeah. I mean it seems like a very bold kind of thing she's saying, right?
Yeah. I was absolutely astonished at it. I mean the implication of it is pretty – well, it's downright seditious.
But also just making this she was making just to what we're doing. She's playing this parlor game, making this parallel, saying that these you had these you know these princelings in power, and you basically had a group of you know that would be analogous to the CEOs today in
exactly.
league with those
that was,
in
that
power.
Was very interesting too.
You know who those in power
the
had
CEOs
this,
of state run enterprises.
State run enterprises, yeah. It's very courageous sort of parallel to make. But I'm not so sure. I fear for her head, maybe.
Well, apparently she's married to a Westerner and spells her name in a Taiwanese fashion, so she can.
They can't find her online. Okay.
Well, I think one thing about this too, and I think it's an important. Again, the parallels aren't exact, but where this essay is pointing is a very important lesson from that period, which is that the urban elites of that time, the first decade of the 20th century, were willing to work or allow the Qing government to reform as long as the Qing government continued to reform, as long as it continued to promise certain things to keep on changing in order to allow for the kind of spaces economically and otherwise that they needed to find fulfillment, whether that's economic fulfillment or other political fulfillment. What happened, though, after 1908, after the Guangxu Emperor is poisoned, after Cixi dies and they install Puyi on the throne.
She's the poodle.
And and she packs the cabinet with all of these hardcore Manchu princes.
That's right.
And at that point, that's when a lot of the people who are willing to give the Qing court a break and say, okay, we're willing to work with them, willing to see what's going to happen, when it was clear that this was – that there was a limit to how much they would change, that's when they turned against them. And so when 1911 happened and the Wuchang Uprising occurred, which is really one of the most ridiculous episodes in revolutionary history –
the comedy of it is very high, but what's the analogy? So what are we warning against? It's warning against packing the 18th Party Congress. Packing
well, I think it's warning.
Paul
it's warning against
with
that,
too many hardliners.
That eventually the Communist Party is going to run out of the kind of reforms, or is going to run out of reforms to give people. At that point, what is the reaction?
Well, it's meaning that given that, as people say, their legitimacy is rests upon these economic reforms, if they reach a point where those reforms, as you say, conflict with their hold on power and they're not willing to go any further for some reason, then what you have is they lose their legitimacy, and you get an you get the parallel to the Wuchang uprising, whatever it'll be called.
I mean, but the ominous undertone, of course, is that it's next year.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
This is that right?
The Feng Tai uprising, right, exactly, or whatever. Yeah,
whatever year it is. Very interesting. What are some of the other analogies that are invoked by Chinese, either by the government itself or by critics of the government? One of the you brought up, I thought was kind of an interesting one. Maybe that's it's brought up only subliminally. It's invoked kind of subliminally. They would never come out and say Ti and Yong, you know, Zhong Ti Xi Yong. Using Chinese essence and Western I've never found a sense.
Utility, yeah.
Western, right.
It's the Ti means body or corpus, the essence of Chinese culture versus the utility of the foreign
technology.
Yeah. So this was the debates, you could explain it.
Right, during the self-strengthening movement, really in the 1860s, this idea that you could graft on foreign technology,
without losing the essence of Chinese
exactly,
culture.
Exactly, using that Western Yong to preserve in some way the Chinese tea. Yeah. Do you find parallels to that today?
Well, to my mind, this has never stopped. I mean, the actual use of that terminology, those two characters kind of petered out. But even through the May 4th movement and even through the, through the Mao period even a little bit, but especially in the 80s when it opened up again and then in recent, I don't think that's ever really gone away. And you see it in the echoes of it in the bourgeois liberalization movements and the spiritual pollution movements where there's always this feeling, they want to bring in the foreign technology. They want to bring in the things that are useful. They want to bring in science. They want to bring in these things. But there's a nervousness about the fact that these things drag in with them the concomitant sort of Western ideas and, ways
Internet,
of looking at
anybody.
Things. And the recent one, of course, is what I thought of it was the Green Dam, which is the clumsiest attempt to say, all right, well, we're all behind the internet, full force. We need it for commerce. We need it for everything. We can't. But isn't there some way that we can retain the Chinese tea and keep out all these stupid Western
Chinese
things
tea.
That we don't want?
All the
and
tea in China.
Yeah. That's right. They wanted to keep all their tea in China. And it seems like it's a losing battle, but it's a subtext for a lot of discussion that goes on all the time throughout all the decades.
Yeah, this is one that I'm constantly making conscious reference, not necessarily out loud, but I see flare-ups of this constantly.
Well, I mean, even last week in the English edition of the Global Times, there was an editorial talking about universal values as a Trojan horse. For in China, and the language they used was strikingly similar to some of the conservative criticisms of the self-strengthening movement back in the 1870s. Western ideology, this is a quote, Western ideology has swept most parts of the world except for a few strong religious regions. China is probably the only country that learns and absorbs Western culture but retains its spiritual independence.
Wow.
There you go.
And the spiritual Trojan horse is meant to numb Chinese people and start their eventual spiritual surrender.
Yeah. So there you go. That's beautiful. I mean, yeah. And the He Ping Yan Bian, you're trying to evolve us from. It's like their visceral reaction against the idea of that there could be something like universal values, is part of that too.
Absolutely.
What do you mean? We have to have our own Chinese values. I mean, when the Americans drafted the Jefferson and drafted the Constitution. They were, explicitly putting in things that they considered to be universal values. I mean, they felt no need to draw upon something that was indigenous. We're trying to find something that's, objectively human.
Right.
But there's this resistance to that, part of the Chinese that maybe reveals sort of an implicit thinking of them again as the Middle Kingdom thinking. There's us versus the rest of the world practically, and why should we incorporate?
And no part of you has any empathy for that.
Well, I mean, this idea that there's one political system for all countries, I think, is a really hard idea to get behind. But because there isn't one size fits all doesn't mean that there aren't some things out there that do have application across the spectrum of human experience. You don't need to have multi-party, national, one-person, one-vote elections for every country necessarily. But, there's an idea that maybe people should have the freedom to be able to argue about whether or not that system works for them. Mm. And the challenge, of course, for the Communist Party, and this gets back to something we talked about a few minutes ago, is that, any weakening of these ideological controls for them appears to be some kind of slippery slope. You know, if they happen to let the debate about the 1911 revolution or the meaning of reform at that time enter a wider zeitgeist, if you will, you know, there's this idea, well, that may just start – people may start asking increasingly embarrassing questions. So they just shut it all down from the very beginning, and they take, you know, rather ridiculous stances against universal values that – put them, you know, I know they don't really care that much about the, and people argue about this, but I don't feel they care that much about what the international audience thinks. But when they come across, when they come out with editorials like these in the Global Times, you know, it doesn't do very much to help China's much vaunted attempt at, you know, increasing its soft power, cultural footprint, or whatever the hell they're calling it this week.
What else do we have? What other analogies can we drudge up? The Taiping Rebellion. Dave, when we were getting this together, you were suggesting that this might be sort of a Jungian archetype for the Flugies, for the FLG.
is that what we're calling it now?
Yeah, the Flugies, right. For the nightmare.
It sounds like I've got in my lungs right now.
Oh, the Flugies, yeah.
Well, I defer to Jeremiah's superior historical knowledge.
Knowledge of the Taiping Rebellion is inherited. My grandfather – I'm just going to boast here for a second. My grandfather was Guo Tingyi, and he sort of wrote the book on the Taiping.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The foremost scholar of the Taiping Tianguo. But and unfortunately, that isn't passed down genetically, and so my knowledge of it comes almost entirely from Jonathan Spence.
Well, it's I can't claim that kind of lineage at all, but I do think that we see a pattern here, and it goes before the Taiping Rebellion.
It goes back.
Oh, there were many such rebellions.
Yeah, but this is a play that gets called every single time, and it's like you're watching a football game, and they run the ball three times, four times in a row, they don't make it, and they keep doing the same thing, and you know the play is something like this. There is a group, a religious group, what is considered to be a heterodox group, possibly with millenarian tendencies, if you will.
A xie jiao.
Exactly, a xie jiao. Mm-hmm. And then the government gets nervous, and what they do is they ban the group. What this does, of course, is all the normal people, like the workaday folks who just kind of were sort of interested in this, they leave. Leaving a hardcore group around a charismatic leader. It doesn't matter if it's the white.
So they create.
It really does look
they
like
artificially
that.
Create a yes. successful cult.
Well, I mean, I don't think that the Flugies have been successful by any stretch of the imagination.
Well,
the pattern is similar.
When I go to my mom's hometown library in the U.S. and I can find the complete works of Li Hongzhi, they're pristine. That's somewhat.
Speak not his name.
Mr.
The
Li,
other guy with
Master
three characters
Li,
in his name.
Then that's quite an amount of success for a group that started out to be obscure. But you know,
libraries in Michigan.
This is one case where I think a little knowledge of history would have helped the Western press and the Western observers who are frankly sometimes kind of puzzled at why the CCP. Attacked this group with such vehemence.
Right.
And they were. And we were here. I mean, I was here at the time.
I was too, yeah.
And it was every night, unrelentingly,
absolutely.
You know, on the CCTV. And to foreign observers, it was like, what's going on here?
Yeah,
why
and
are
I
they?
Think it would have really helped. If
it would have helped if they had
the
known
backstory,
that China has this history.
Yeah,
and
the
that
red
they were,
eyebrows, the yellow turbans, and the
this was
the
not
white
the first
Lotus
time this had happened.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And also the Taiping's have another special kind of place too, because it's not just a revolutionary group like we're calling them the Flugies now. Okay, the visions of Chinese Wycliffe John, but the Taiping Rebellion also is kind of hard to catch for a lot of Chinese historians because you know in the 1960s
they were the good guys.
Well, you know where you came down the Taiping Rebellion was sort of where you came down on the idea of the PRC versus the Republic of China.
Sure.
Yes.
And it's still a little confusing
to history students exactly how to look at it. Yeah.
Very, very interesting.
I mean, Zheng Guofan, who I study a lot for my own research, went through a kind of rehabilitation beginning in the 90s as a model for business and living and all kinds of things. But
because
he
used to be Zhang Jieshi's model.
Yeah, well, he used to be just the traitorous, you know, Zheng Guofan who, you know, put down the poor Taiping peasant rebellion.
Right.
You know, another thing, too, about the Taiping, which is interesting, is a lot of Chinese aren't really that up on his religious leanings. It's the whole younger brother of Jesus Christ thing. That a lot of people actually don't either. They kind of know or they don't really.
That's
care
downplayed. That's completely downplayed. Because I've seen my wife used to teach history, and I've seen history books, and that's totally downplayed.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, I've seen the sort of Hakka ethnic explanations and things like that, but I rarely do I see the actual content of the religious content of the ideology.
Because God knows, it's all my students ever remember.
Yeah.
It's like, the guy who thought he was the younger brother of Jesus Christ was put down by a guy named Zung, a guy named Lee, and the guy they named the chicken dish after. This is the essay answer. This is the essay answer.
That's right. That's good. That's good.
That's good. That is very good. I mean, that I'll remember that.
I'll remember that, yeah.
When we were talking about sort of what it would have been useful for people to know, what are some of the things that you found when you're talking to both of you talk to reporters often on stories? What's useful to explain from history to help people get a more nuanced grasp of what's happening today? Let me go first. I've got a good one. I'm often asked about the how it is that the same guy can at once be apparently quite cosmopolitan, maybe even lives abroad. This happened during 2008, during the torch relay, when you saw a lot of patriotic Chinese abroad come out and really kind of denouncing the Tibetan independence folks, really denouncing the whole criticism of the torch relay and coming out in very rabid support of the torch relay. A lot of these people were quite cosmopolitan. They're often citizens of the countries that they've emigrated to. They embrace pluralistic politics. They are otherwise quite liberal, but you scratch the surface and there's this sort of seething nationalist underneath. Why is that? And I found an historical explanation I always fall back on is I say, look, in China, nationalism and liberalism developed in lockstep. The idea of embracing science and democracy, of nobody except possibly Liang Qichao, and maybe just Liang Qichao was probably the only person I'm aware of in the intellectual firmament of the early 20th century who was into liberalism qua liberalism. He saw it as an end in itself. Everyone else saw it as a sort of Tiyong thing. This was the path to Western wealth and power. Science and democracy. And so if the means and the end come into conflict, if the means is liberalism and the end is national strength, what's going to win out in the end? When your liberal and national commitments conflict, your nationalism will triumph. So, I mean, I've explained that and I've gotten a lot of sort of understanding nods from that pitch. Are there other pieces of Chinese history that you feel like
we just mentioned this a second ago, although we argued about the terminology, which is exceptional. It used to be more so than now, but I remember in the 80s, it wouldn't take too many beers in a group of Chinese at a dinner before the topic would turn around to what happened to China? How did we lose it? We should be where the West is right now. And analyzing how it happened. And the implicit feeling is we should be where the U.S. is now. I mean, why are we not? Mm-hmm. The topic has changed a little bit now, and the timbre has changed a little bit now.
Yeah, it's like how soon until we are again.
Yes. How do we complete this? But China always has a strange kind of nationalism. It's very brittle.
Oh yeah,
it has thin-skinned. Inferiority complex combined
deeply,
with
deeply
a sense
inferior,
of exceptionalism.
Right, exactly.
There's an old joke that applies to Russia, but I think it applies to China. It used to anyway. That a reporter goes to visit the Moscow subway, and the Russian host there is proudly exhibiting them. He says, "Look, see how clean the tracks are. See how there's great murals of socialist realist art there. See how everything is very efficient and the lines form everything." He said, and the reporter says, "Well, yes, comrade, but we've been standing here for 30 minutes. And I haven't seen a train." and the host says, "And what about your slaughter of the American Indians?" And there was something about that, the same kind of dynamic in China when in the 80s and 90s, that when you would bring up, they would say, we're all great friends and everything. But you bring up something and then they would suddenly say, well, what about you? And I think that's tough for people to understand, because I think the average American or the foreigners very, very often think that the Chinese or citizenry are sitting here seething against the oppression and evil of their leadership, and that they can't wait to immigrate or topple the. This is what they. This is what tends to be the.
Why
Western
don't
image.
Them Chinese hate their government as much as I think they ought to?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think there's two parts there. I mean, play a little bit on what Kaiser said about Liang Qichao in that era. The May 4th. To see what's a historical parallel, the May 4th actual incident, I think, really was a watershed for a whole generation. I mean, before that, there were a lot of ideas, liberalism, anarchism, socialism, all kinds of things. But one, you know, the Chinese got so royally screwed with their pants on at Versailles by these Western governments. And this made it very difficult to sort of look at Western liberalism as a positive force. And also at the same time, a lot of intellectuals in China were having the same crisis of faith intellectuals all over the world were in the wake of the Great War, which was all this progress, you know, all these systems led to this, the horrible slaughter in the fields of France and Belgium. And after that, I think after 1919, a lot of people said, you know, listen, we're looking around the world and it's basically a Darwinian battle for survival. Only the strong will survive. And liberalism, that was really, really nice. And that would be great if we could do that. But we need something to be strong now. Hmm. And this leads me to the, you know, the other point, which was what I try to explain to people who ask questions. And being only a graduate student, I don't get asked by reporters a whole lot. But I do get asked by my students quite a bit. And the one thing I try to remind them is history looks different from a Chinese perspective. I know that seems like a sort of a truism, but we forget that. In the United States, the things of our dystopian nightmares, Darth Vader, you know, is the tyranny, the all-powerful central authoritarian state. In China, looking back, the real evils in history haven't occurred in times of great tyranny, really, or at least the way history is remembered. It's always occurred in times when the government's been too weak. Cultural revolution, the Japanese invasion, the whole 19th century, the century of humiliation. Now, part of that is also the way history is presented in a very specific way in the Chinese educational system. It tends to play up this point. But it's not an unreasonable way to look at least the last 200 years. And so for many Chinese, they will look at this and say, you know what? Yes. Human rights is a problem here. It kind of sucks that things are censored. And that guy with the three-character name who just won the Peace Prize, you know, that's not a good thing that this happened, but, you know, it is what it is. The same kind of – the way I explain it to my students is, you know, when you are at home and you have a Chinese friend who's sitting there looking at the guy on the sleeping on the subway grate in New York City and goes, what the hell is going on here? You say, well, you know, it's not good. It's just kind of a byproduct of our system, but, you know
– but we live with it.
We live with it. Or why does everyone have a gun in the United States? Well, you know, well, it's because our Constitution gives certain freedoms and we can't have – you know,
because, you know, we keep a well-regulated militia.
It's what do you, it's what you choose to care about. And so the reason why, you know, Kaiser is saying, why aren't they all rising up against them, their government – since I guess we're really stereotyping the South today for no apparent reason. part of it's because they're looking like, you know what? It's not great, but it's better than what I perceive the alternative to be. Mm-hmm. Whether that's a false dichotomy or not, I don't know. I mean, what do you think, David?
Well, you know, I think the Chinese revolutions by and large have been not to get more freedom but to get more state control. I mean, that was the goal of them, and that's something, you know, that you were talking about. But there's also this thing of, that you mentioned about that they're reminded by their education and their history, you know. And there's something that people have to realize is that part of Chinese nationalism is humiliation, is the history of humiliation. That's right. That's where they draw a lot of their domestic support. That's where they draw a lot of their moral support, their moral justification. And this victimization that they feed on, that the party is fed on, you know, look at Yuan Mingyuan, look at how they treat the historically. That has worked for them in a certain sense, because if you're always a victim, you know, it gets expressed by saying things like, you've hurt the feelings of the Chinese people. You know, there you go, hurting our feelings again. We're always the victims. There's a moral superiority there that we haven't done anything. We're the victims and you guys are the aggressors and this sort of thing. Look what you did. You burned our great, you know, Yuan Mingyuan. You did all these things with the Opium Wars and all this kind of stuff. But as China begins to pull out of that and becomes, you know, a major player, they become a world power, they get a little more influence in the region, that sort of becomes empty, and they can't keep falling back on that as for their moral compass, you know. And it begins to be a transition period where they can't keep saying that we're victims all the time.
I want to go back to something that Jeremiah said. I think you raised a really, really interesting point, and I felt like, you know, you were almost there with this idea that we both read Joseph Levinson, and I think this is stuff that comes kind of straight out of him. People ask me why the Chinese embraced communism. And, you know, you were talking about this in the aftermath of the Great War. They've already kind of gone through this thoroughgoing repudiation of their own traditions of Confucianism and the patriarchal family system. So they're not certainly going to turn back and become traditionalists. But they're so disillusioned with the Western imperial powers that have screwed them so royally at Versailles on the Shandong issue. What are they looking for? They're looking for something that appears to be scientific, which at least can make scientific claims, that comes from a Western mind. It comes from the minds of Marx and Engels and Lenin, especially with his critique of imperialism. And at the same time explains why they're in their plight.
Their historical predicament. Yes.
Explains their historical predicament and gives them an incredible future.
Yeah, in some ways it's scientific, which is very important.
At the time, yes.
It's seen as a more advanced form of organization. And the thing about it, it's also Western, but it's not Western.
Exactly. It's Western, but it's anti-Western.
It's a critique but of also the essence fact of the Western trajectory.
But the fact I think it's coming from Russia is very important. Because if you think about where Russia exists in the Chinese mind, even think about in the Qing Dynasty, Russia was handled by the Li Fan Yuan as a Central Asian power.
That's right.
It's always seen as been kind Asiatic. Of Western, but kind of not. And I think the fact that Bolshevism and Marxism kind of came through Russia, this also helped. I mean, as David said, yes, it also explicitly critiques the Western assault on Chinese sovereignty at the time, which is very important, and also the capitalist system that was exploiting China at the time. But I also think the fact that it came from Russia, which was seen as another large land-based former empire, I think that helped to have a great deal of appeal as well.
Even before the Bolshevik Revolution, the people who were drawn toward Bolshevism and drawn toward revolutionary flavors of Marxism, these guys were real liberals. I mean, they were ideologically committed liberals. I mean, Chen Duxiu and Li Dajiao. Very interesting. Since we don't have too much time left, without going into them in any depth, let's look at a couple of the other things that people often dredge up from history. Do we really need to understand the Boxers to understand contemporary nationalism? I'm going to throw some of these out here, and if anything grabs you, just shout out. Do we need to understand the Confucian civil service examination system to understand the ascendancy of technocrats in today's China? This is a favorite theme of mine. Is Mao really the last in a line of imperial despots? Last? do the Opium Wars. This is one you guys have all shouted out about in the past. Do we need to understand – I mean, John Cassidy just wrote something in The New Yorker that basically suggests this. The Opium Wars, do they shed some light on the current trade imbalance with the West or how that whole thing has played out?
I'd like talking about the Opium Wars a little bit too, and this goes back to something David had said speaking with his Chinese friends early on, what happened to us. In some ways, that's a Chinese echo of a question that was asked by 19th and early 20th century social scientists, what happened to China? And with the rather implicit idea that China somehow failed. It didn't have an industrial revolution. It didn't modernize. And it used to be kind of – the question was whose fault was it? Some of the older schools of Chinese history, and I'm thinking of like the John Fairbanks era, which is the 1940s, 1950s, argue that, it was a lot of internal problems with China with little help from imperialism. This changed in the 60s and 70s when, journals like
Mark Elvin was one of the.
Well, the Bulletin of Concerned Asian Scholars and that generation were like, no, it's imperialism. This is what happened to China.
Well, that was an unfortunate aberration. I mean, I think that didn't last long, the sort of.
No, it didn't. And then the third wave, which is sort of the China-centered, which is the 1980s, 1990s way of looking at it, kind of is going back to more of a. Imperialism was a sort of disease, but there were other things going on there too. I kind of got away from my point here a minute, but the
quite all right. As we enjoyed the
point here. The point was actually that one of the things that we need to kind of I would like the Western commentators to get away from is this idea that somehow China just made a wrong turn somewhere, that it was an inevitability that China should have entered the comedy of Christian nations somewhere in the 19th century. Or that, the Qianlong Emperor in 1796 with his famous and dismissive letter to King George III had made some tragic error.
Yeah. I think this is a good point you're raising. It's sort of another one of these things that Westerners need to understand. This assumption that China, somehow should have then or certainly should be now be moving towards a Western-style democracy, And it's something that we need to realize that the Chinese certainly don't see it that way. And the word they use over and over again is guoqing. You know, right. We have a different national situation. And by that, they don't just mean the objective situation, the infrastructure, the geography. They also mean the cultural background.
They also mean the guoqing. They also mean the national essence.
Yeah, exactly. And whenever I used to hear that long ago, I mean, I always thought of it as an excuse because it was usually raised in terms of human rights. And they would say, you can't criticize us for human rights because our guoqing is different than yours. And I used to think, right. You know, no, it isn't. I mean, essentially, it's the same dynamic. You're bullying a bunch of powerless people who are speaking out against you. But the more – as time goes on, the more I think they're deeply right about that. They do have a different guoqing, and I think that's – we shouldn't have expected it then, and we shouldn't expect it now for them to be moving in any direction exactly paralleling ours or you know – they're going to have a different system. They're going to have a different set of cultural assumptions, and that includes human rights, right? And it touches upon what you said about, you know, seeing bums on the subway in New York City is a human rights issue that we tend to, you know, overlook. But that's our guoqing, you know, as you, that's the point you were making. And I think that this way of looking at things will sort of take the blinders off a lot of foreigners who look at this thing and think.
Also take the gloves off, though. That's what my concern is that. I mean, Jim Mann makes sort of that same point, right? But he does it in a sort of and the implication is that conflict is unavoidable.
Well, conflict, again, conflict doesn't have to lead to war or anything. You know, conflict can be ideological. It can be, you know, philosophical. It can still – this cooperation still can – it shouldn't lead to unreasonable expectations or totally fantasies about what China can be or what it should be. I think it touches on nationalism too when you see Chinese doggedly defending their own country's actions in certain cases or even including – treatment of, for example, the guy sitting in prison right now. There's a point there that we should at least respect, which is that they're coming at it from a different set of problems. They have a different set of – panoply of problems than we have.
So at the end of this, I think we can all say that, you know, read your history. Really, do read your history. It does matter. It matters not just for the Western scholars. Yeah. It matters also because we need to understand how the lens through which Chinese people view their own circumstances. I'm really afraid that that's all we have time for today. Jeremiah, thanks so much for coming. It was great to have you again.
Thanks, Kaiser.
And we'll have you back again soon. David, thanks as always. And both of you, let's see, in the new year, I think we're not going to have an episode next week. I want to thank you all for listening to Seneca. We are looking forward to bringing you more timely topics and more terrific guests in the coming year. Happy New Year. Happy holidays to all of us, to all of you, from all of us.
新年快乐.
From the Seneca crew, and this is Kaiser signing out. Take care. Bye.